there's another paper from more recently in July. It'll comprise the third act of the talk. And for that, there was also another paper that came out on the same day from Son and a student at the Sea of Ashgolkar. And I also recommend taking a look at that. And then I probably won't be able to talk about work in progress, but if I can, great. And then I would also be remiss if I did not mention my fantastic collaborators. And there really are several of them. Matthias Kaminski out at Seattle, Pavel Koftun and Adam Ritz at Victoria, Logan Iagam out of Harvard, and Amos Jerome, who is now at the Technion. So without any further ado, let me begin. The context for today's talk is, well, if you were a nuclear person, you would say the context are things like the chiral magnetic effect and the chiral vortical effect in four dimensions. You might ask, what are those things? Well, if you have a fluid at non-zero temperature and parity is violated, then you can have currents that are, in principle, directed along magnetic fields and local vorticity. That's essentially this expression right here. The mu is a space-time index, and I'm just being very general, so capital A's, B's are labels for U1 currents. And in general, I can have a current proportional to a magnetic field with some parity violating coefficient, or a current proportional to a magnetic field with some other parity violating coefficient. And those respective coefficients are known as the chiral magnetic and chiral vortical connectivities, respectively. And, well, they're interesting to theorists, mostly because when people can compute these things, whether by ADS-CFT or in weakly coupled field theory, these connectivities are proportional to the anomaly coefficients of the microscopic theory, and so give you a macroscopic manifestation of the quantum anomaly, which is very interesting. Moreover, it's experimentally accessible. So at heavy ion collisions at RIC or at ATLAS, people are looking for parity-violating correlations, some event-to-event signatures, wherein there is hope that within a few years these things might actually be measured, say, for the quark-gluon plasma. The rest of the context for this talk is some thoughts about hydro, trying to make hydro into something more well understood from quantum field theory as some sort of as an honest quantum-effective field theory for real-world systems at non-zero temperature. And then the way we're going to get all of this is by way of symmetries. So lo and behold, whether in supersymmetric systems, conformal systems, whatever, symmetries are very useful for us and will allow us to make some progress. I should give a disclaimer that although I was raised as an ADS-CFT and probe brain person, this is completely independent of holography. All the calculations that we're going to do are based on very simple properties, like analyticity properties of correlators, symmetries, things like this. However, because we'll be able to make exact statements about field theories at non-zero temperature, there will be some interplay, some things that maybe we can say about ADS-CFT when we're all said and done. So to start off in this talk, I will give a little bit of context to this whole business with these chiral connectivities. I'll talk about how they were seen in hydro, which is worth summarizing because the story that you get from doing exact calculations reproduces those results precisely. So I'll review how Son and a student at the time, Peter Soroka, arrived at these connectivities in hydro. And then from there, we're going to switch veins, and we're going to work and derive some exact results. And what we'll do is we'll work in essentially time-independent equilibria. So field theory with various background fields that depend on space but not on time. And what can we say about those things? And then the third part will be to clear up some, well, if you don't know what this is now, you'll know what it is later in the talk, this business with a T-squared term and the CVE. You'll know by then, and I probably won't have the chance to talk about new things, but if we can, we'll get there. The field theories that I'll be talking about today will be relativistic theories in two dimensions and four dimensions. We could talk about odd-dimensional theories, but then we don't have anomalies, so they're a little bit less interesting. And these theories will have some global symmetries. I imagine them being products of U1s or global coordinate or just coordinate invariants. Of course, you can generalize this to talk about non-abelian currents, blah, 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 blah. But these theories are really interesting for us today because they exhibit a tragic flaw. These global symmetries are, in fact, anomalous. However, as we learned from Shakespeare in theater throughout most of the last 600 years or so, tragic flaws make for an interesting story. And so we will hope to learn a few things about our theories as a result of these anomalies. And we'll learn about them by making the anomalies known by coupling these theories to background fields, which I'll notate as gauge fields with an A mu and metric as G mu nu in the usual way. And the main idea, if you will, completely separate from this business about the chiral magnetic effect and everything else, is we know that anomalies represent deep, non-perturbative statements in zero-temperature quantum field theory. What are the manifestations of anomalies at non-zero temperature? What kind of exact statements can we make? This is the big idea. And I should say a few words about why we care about this. Exact results in interacting field theory are usually interesting in and of themselves. As I said before, this has an impact for transport coefficients in the quark-gluon plasma at Rick. Also, I probably won't get to talk about this, there may be some relation to topological states of matter as well, constraining parity violating transport in those systems, like topological insulators. And then I think one of the really interesting things that come out of this is that once we have exact results in field theory, we can apply them as a precision test to holography, or quantum gravity in general. And in particular, since we're looking at things in the hydro limits where there's a well-defined notion of entropy or an entropy current, this may be interesting. We may be able to learn something about exact contributions to black hole entropy from anomalies. Okay. Let me say a few words. There's some machinery that's running around in the background of everything I'm talking about today that you may not have seen before. And it's just good old-fashioned quantum field theory, and it's worth saying a few words about. When you have a theory that has an anomaly, let's talk about the generating functional for correlation functions. We're going to call that W. There's at least two different definitions for the currents of a theory with an anomaly. The first one is the one that you're used to from ADS-CFT. Differentiate the generating functional with respect to some background field. However, there's a one-line calculation, and there it is, that shows you that these currents, these so-called consistent currents of the theory, are actually, they fail to be gauge covariant. The way you see this is you can take a gauge variation of, say, a current, dot it into a fluctuation of a gauge field, and then, well, that's the same thing as the variation, the double variation, a gauge field variation followed by a gauge variation of the generating functional, which you can interchange. So do the gauge variation first and then do an A variation. But the gauge variation of the generating functional just picks out the divergence of the current, which, say, for the U1 anomaly in four dimensions, it's like F wedge F. And then, well, that thing has a knot. Like, if you vary F wedge F with respect to A, you get something non-zero. What that tells you is a U1 consistent current, when there's an anomaly, is not gauge invariant. It's gauge invariant, however, up to a single additive term, which is built out of the background fields. That single additive term is something that's known as the Bardeen-Zumino polynomial, or PBZ here. And so if you just add that term back to the current, then you get something that's gauge covariant again. These are the so-called covariant currents. Just about everything I'm going to be talking about today is about the covariant currents. The second thing that I should say is something that you probably know, but just to say the words. If you have a theory with an anomaly, there are certain consistency conditions that the anomaly has to satisfy. So in other words, you can't simply have a divergence of J something being something completely arbitrary. The allowed anomalies are classified by solving the West-Zumino consistency conditions, and this allows you a complete classification of anomalies in any given dimension. I'm rather than saying what happens in general, let me just say that in two dimensions, there's two types of anomalies that you can have. You can have a gauge anomaly, you can have a gravitational anomaly, which you know from your 2D CFT, since we're all string theorists. So the divergence of the covariant current can go like epsilon mu nu f mu nu, and the divergence of the covariant stress tensor can have a Joule heating term that corresponds to the fact that you have a background gauge field coupling to a U1 current plus something that looks like an anisymmetric derivative of the Ricci scalar for the background. And in four dimensions, well, you also have a gauge anomaly, the famous Adler-Bardeen-Jacku anomaly, but then there's also a mixed gauge gravitational anomaly. And when I say mixed, I mean it in the following sense. If you look at the divergence of the covariant current, it can have two terms. One is essentially F wedge F, and the other is trace R squared. And then the divergence of the stress tensor has the usual Joule heating term, plus a term that's like an anisymmetric derivative of the field strength wedge the Riemann curvature 2 form. And in that sense, the anomaly is mixed. You only see it in the divergence of the stress tensor when you have non-vanishing background field strengths as well as non-vanishing curvature. Okay. So that's the background I need to get out of the way before actually doing calculations. Let's review how people saw this anomaly-induced transport in hydro. In order to do that, I have to say a few words about hydro. And so let me do this from something of a modern perspective, because, first off, most of us probably don't see hydro when we take graduate courses in physics. And then the second issue being that the way hydro is understood has changed substantively from the 1950s, where the classic texts were written, and now. So let me give you a modern treatment in like four slides. So start off with your favorite field theory in some time-independent equilibrium state in flat space. That state's labeled by a variety of parameters. You can have a temperature, you can have a chemical potential, and you can have a fluid velocity. By a fluid velocity, well, actually, by all these things, it's easier to think about these things in terms of Euclidean field theory. Take your equilibrium state, Euclideanize it, and then what you mean by temperature is like the inverse length of the time circle in the Euclideanization. The chemical potential you can relate to the log of the Polyakov loop of the gauge field around the time circle. And then the fluid velocity is really just the tangent vector to, if you will, Euclidean time. Okay. Well, in such a state, the general coordinate invariance is, if you will, like spontaneously broken down just to rotational invariance. You have a rotational subgroup that preserves this time-like vector, call it u mu. And as a result, you can decompose one-point functions of any operator that you want into various representations of the rotation group, the residual rotation invariance. So the current is a vector. It has to be along the only non-zero vector in the game. So you can call the thing in front of it rho, ends up just being the ordinary charge density. And the stress tensor has two terms. You can have a term that goes like u mu u nu, and you can have another term that goes like another combination of the transverse projector, if you will, to this velocity. So that's the equilibrium state. There's the one-point functions in that state on symmetry alone, provided that you're not in some screwy region of the phase diagram where the equilibrium state breaks rotational invariance or various other things that can happen usually if you have very, very low temperatures. Just study rotationally invariant states. Now, in order to develop hydro, the first big idea that you do is you say, well, let's study fluctuations around this equilibrium state. And we'll do so by promoting the parameters that describe the equilibrium state to space-time fields. If you will, this is like an effective field theory where you try to identify the low energy degrees of freedom. That's the first big step in hydro. And the second is that, just like in ordinary effective field theory, you express quantities, in this case, one-point functions, in a derivative expansion of these space-time fields. as well as actually, since we have background fields as well, there'll also be terms that involve gradients of the background fields. And then you take your favorite tensor structure that you can write down that's allowed by symmetry, say the divergence of the fluid velocity times this projector, and you can put that into the stress tensor with some coefficient in front, give it a name. That's a transport coefficient. This is analogous to saying that, well, in an effective field theory, you write down terms with a given number of derivatives, and you put independent coefficients, independent couplings in front of each one. This is the hydro analog of that. The third big idea is that, well, if you compute correlation functions in a quantum field theory, these fields, T, mu, or U, mu, they're not sensibly defined, say, with a path integral. So you have to determine them somehow in terms of the other background fields in the theory. And one way of doing that is to impose the conservation of the stress tensor in the current, or if you will, to impose Ward identities. And you can check that there's as many equations here as there are fields that are parameterizing your fluctuation from equilibrium. In other words, solving these equations for those fields gives you a well-defined system of equations, and the result will give you the stress tensor as a functional of background fields, and similarly for the current. You have a well-defined differential system up to initial conditions. The fourth big idea is, and I'm not going to say very much about this, it's just that there are lots of field redefinitions that you can do in hydro to get rid of spurious transport coefficients. So you can get rid of, this is analogous to getting rid of terms in some effective Lagrangian by field redefinitions. And in the literature, this is known as a change of hydrodynamic frame. There's Landau-Lifshitz frame, there's Eckhart frame, blah, 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 blah. And it should be, now one thing that's worth saying about the physics here, I've used the language of effective field theory as for a reason. This is, the language used in constructing hydro is almost the exact same as used in constructing effective field theory, which is very suggestive that perhaps we can, if we're smart enough and work hard enough, get rid of hydro altogether and talk about write down a Lagrangian for the low energy effective field theory for field theory at non-zero temperature. Okay, those are the various big ideas. However, that is not enough. At this point in the story, Landau enters the room and forcibly stops you from proceeding because he tells you that there is another consistency condition on hydro that you should demand in order to proceed. And that is that there exists some notion of a quantity that's called an entropy current rather than just an entropy. And you might ask, well, what is this thing? The idea that he had was that one should impose the second law locally in some fluid configuration that solves the hydro equations. It's on shell. So what is a statement that entropy grows mean in some time-dependent state? Well, you demand that there's some current whose divergence is always positive. And then you interpret like the longitudinal component of that thing as the local entropy density, which always grows. And this condition is very interesting, actually. In first-order hydro, by first-order hydro, I mean hydro where you keep terms with one derivative in your expressions for the one-point functions. It kills two transport coefficients and tells you that the three remaining ones all have to be positive with some appropriate convention of signs. So this is what you end up with. You can have a current that in one particular hydro frame has a piece that just looks like a charge density, and then, oh, there should be parentheses around here, sorry. There's some convective term telling you how the current couples to an electric field, to fluctuations of chemical potential and temperature, with a coefficient sigma for conductivity, and then the stress tensor can have the usual ideal fluid piece plus two terms. These things are known as viscosity. If you've ever seen the KSS bound eta over S is 4 pi, this is the same eta. This is the shear viscosity. And Landau tells you that all those coefficients should be positive. All right. That's hydro. Let's bring in the anomalies. Well, and let's say we work in four dimensions. So this was an analysis that was done by Son and Piotr Soroka back in 2009. And what they did was very simple. They said, well, when we have anomalies, then there are some covariant currents, gauge invariant currents, lying around. They obey that conservation equation. The stress tensor is conserved up to Joule heating. And so you impose those equations of motion instead of the usual conservation equations. And when you have an anomaly, it usually means you have broken parity. When you have broken parity, that allows you to write down more transport coefficients, more tensor structures that can contribute to the one-point functions. And well, if you sit down and try to grind out all possible parity-violating tensor structures, you find out there's only two pseudo-vectors. They're the magnetic field and the vorticity. The magnetic field is like epsilon, the fluid velocity dotted into the field strength, and the vorticity is epsilon u dotted into du. And all right, so you have new transport coefficients. And then they said, well, let's write down the most general possible entropy current and then classify the space of entropy currents that all satisfy the Landau criterion that give you a positive divergence. When you do this, remarkably enough, it fixes those two parity-violating transport coefficients entirely, up to integration constants, actually. The way this works is this condition that like grad S is bigger than or equal to zero, what it does, the contributions from these two transport coefficients are T violating. And so you could imagine if you have some fluid flow switching time, considering like the T conjugate fluid flow, and those terms would give you entropy production with the opposite sign. What this tells you is that the coefficient in front of those things has to vanish. And what that gives you is a set of differential equations for the transport coefficients. You solve them, and you get this, where R is the, it's like the U1 charge density over the enthalpy. And this is really interesting. You have transport coefficients that know about anomalies. And this is how you get it. And I should say that while it looks like there's three different integration constants here, F1, F2, and F3, if you're careful, CPT actually kills two of them, F1 and F3. So that, in other words, transport coefficients are completely determined by the coefficient of the U1 anomaly, CA, some integration constant, CPT preserving constant, F2, and then factors of temperature, chemical potential, thermodynamic quantities. Is everyone good so far? Okay, so this is what Song and Soroka did. But it's in hydro, so you might ask, can we really trust it? Can we understand these things just from field theory? And that's where the rest of the talk comes in. Now we're just going to do honest field theory. Well, actually, I'm actually not going to do any like diagrammatic calculations or anything, or prove non-renormalization theorems, things like that. I'm actually going to be much more naive, and I'm going to exploit simple facts about Euclidean field theory. And this is my list of all the properties that I need in order to proceed. So the first fact I need is that. Oh, and I should say one more thing before going on, which is for various physical reasons, everything we do from here on out, we're going to consider taking our theory and coupling it to time-independent background fields. The basic idea why you would do this is that when you turn on time-independent background fields, there's no dissipation in your system. It's like in some generalized equilibrium state. So in principle, it should be a lot easier to describe. Second, time-independent, when you consider time-independent background fields, those are nicely related to Euclidean correlation functions, which are simpler to talk about than the real-time CTP stuff. And furthermore, there are additional symmetries that emerge in equilibrium. And those extra symmetries will be very useful for us. OK, so we're working in a time-independent equilibrium, and then there's lots of facts about these things. The first is that all of the various real-time functions, if you've ever played with like real-time correlation functions at non-zero temperature, you know that they're a mess, that they're related to this Schwinger-Keldysh contour, and there's all these different prescriptions. You can have RA, RRA, RRR correlation, all these messy, bloody things. And, well, if you look at zero frequency functions, all of these different prescriptions are all proportional to the corresponding Euclidean correlation function. This was some old result that Tim Evans showed back in the early 90s by carefully grinding out all the analytic continuations. That's one useful thing. So we don't need to talk about real-time functions, we only need to talk about Euclidean correlation functions. The second thing that we'll use is that, well, most theories, or the ones that we care about usually, have zero frequency functions which are analytic at small momentum. This is a manifestation of screening, if you will. For instance, if you were to compute Euclidean correlation functions for n equals 4 from ADS CFT at non-zero temperature, this is exactly what you would find. The poles that you would get in correlation functions are displaced from zero momentum. They're at some non-zero momentum. They're related to screening lengths of the plasma, blah, 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 blah. And I should note that while this is true for most theories, it's not true for some. The major cases are the ones that I list there. If you have a superfluid phase, then there's an extra massless mode in the theory that can give you long distance correlations. Similarly, if you have a U1 gauge field, like a dynamical U1 gauge field, then the magnetic screening length for this guy is infinite, so there's long range fluctuations of the U1 field. And also, if you tune your theory, tune control parameters so that you sit at a critical point, then there's there's long distance fluctuations of an order parameter. But suffice it to say, let's start off with the general case, and then we can always try to build those things back later. Okay, that's all we need, actually. Flush symmetries, yeah.
For n equals 4, is it true order by order and perturbation theory, or is it something non-perturbative?
Let's see. So at strong coupling, just have the answer. At weak coupling,
because the mass, sometimes these masses are proportional to the coupling or the
output. Yeah, so that's because in free fields, for free field theory, the screening lengths are formally infinite for n equals 4. What you, in n equals 4, well, actually, in any non-abelian gauge theory, in any Yang-Mills type theory, there's going to be two screening lengths. There's the electric screening length that suppresses fluctuations of, like, the electric field at long distances, and then there's the magnetic screening length. And the electric one is perturbative. You can get it from the lowest order contribution and perturbation theory just from the vacuum polarization diagram. And that length, that screening mass, inverse screening length, goes like GT. For the magnetic one, that's actually non-perturbative. And it goes like G squared T. Okay, so we have these correlation functions. They're analytic at small momentum. And now suppose that you took the set of all zero frequency functions and you Taylor expanded them to some finite order, call it n, around zero momentum. Call these things truncated correlation functions. Well, by construction, when you Fourier transform these things back to real space, you get something that's local. And now you can imagine convoluting those local functions with factors of background fields, and then integrating over space and constructing the generating functional for these guys. And because all these correlation functions in real space are local, what you'll get will be a local functional of background fields. I should say that this, you might think that this is, I'll just keep going. All right, so summary from that slide, there exists a local functional of time-independent background fields that reproduces low-momentum correlation functions, low-momentum static correlators. Well, rather than going through the procedure that I just outlined and computing all correlation functions and Taylor expanding them, it's obviously much simpler to classify these generating functionals by instead classifying local scalars that can contribute to this guy up to some order in derivatives. this is analogous. So then the task before us is to say up to third order in derivatives, what possible terms could possibly contribute to this W. And now's where you have to be a little bit more careful since we're going to be considering theories to which we turn on a time-independent metric. We have to be a little bit more careful and define covariantly what we mean by time independence. What I really mean is sort of the obvious physical definition that there's some time-like vector field in the geometry in question whose Lie derivative annihilates everything in sight. Annihilates the metric, annihilates the curvatures, blah, 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 blah. Once you have this, then you have the necessary ingredients to define a thermal partition function. You know, some trace e to the minus beta h, because there really is an h. There's a Hamiltonian that generates flows along this vector field. You can think of the corresponding geometry as some U1 vibration over a spatial slice. And then our task when we write down this WN is to write down all possible gauge invariant observables on the spatial slice. Let's actually do this. At zeroth order in derivatives, there's only a few tensor structures that you can write down. The simplest one is just, depending on where you are on the spatial slice, compute the inverse length of the time circle. Call that your local temperature. Really, it's just a functional of the metric. Similarly, you can define a chemical potential out of the inverse length of the time circle and then the Polyakov loop of the gauge field around the time circle at an arbitrary point on the spatial slice. And then finally, once you have this time-like vector field V, you can define another time-like vector field U, which has unit norm, minus unit norm. So U squared is minus 1. You can define all these things from the data of the background metric and gauge field. And that's it. Well, go a step further. Classify all tensor structures at first order in derivatives. Well, there's a field strength that you can build out of differentiating the gauge field. You can dot that into the fluid velocity, and that gives you a vector. You can take the gradient of the fluid velocity and decompose that into the various irreducible representations of the rotation group, and you'll get a vector called A mu, which is just the fluid velocity dotted into grad u. And then there's another term which you can get, which I'm calling omega, which is some transverse traceless 2-tensor that also looks like some appropriate anisymmetric derivative of the fluid velocity u. And if I don't worry about parity violating structures, that's it. Those are all the structures that I can write down up to first order derivatives. And you'll notice that the only scalars there, well, there's no scalars at first order derivatives. The only ones at zeroth order are what I've called t and mu. What that means is that to first order derivatives for a parity preserving theory, this generating functional is just some functional of t and mu, which I've suggestively called p for pressure.
Maybe I lost track. Yeah. Was there a rule in the second line, the first order derivative, that you wanted all tensor structures that were orthogonal to the fourth order?
Let's see. So, no, actually. So this is one interesting statement. So if you compute, say, the gradient of the fluid velocity in terms of the quantities that I've described up there, it is minus u mu a nu plus omega u nu, and nothing else. So there's no scalar part of the gradient of the fluid velocity. And similarly, and moreover, these different functionals that I've written down satisfy some interrelations. So for instance, if you computed the derivative of what I call the temperature, you would get minus the temperature times A mu. Or if you computed the gradient of the chemical potential, you would get minus mu A mu plus the electric field back again. What this is telling you is that, you compute all these gradients, and then all, you can also look at the field strength and decompose that. I think it's like, U mu E mu minus U mu E mu plus something parity violating. And if you stare at these things long enough, you realize that out of all the various things you can write down it with one derivative in them, there are no Lorentz scalars. You only get vectors and tensors. It's an, so in other words, it's an output from the calculation. So one thing that's worth emphasizing, if say we were doing hydro instead of general field theory, then when people write down the gradient and the fluid velocity, there are other terms, like a divergence of the fluid velocity term and a shear term. Both of those tensor structures parametrize out of equilibrium behavior, say give you dissipative transport coefficients. And the fact that you don't see these here is just telling you you're really in equilibrium. All of the tensor structures that give you dissipation are vanishing in these backgrounds. Now I've written out W1 this way, but you should really, this is just some complicated functional of the metric in the gauge field. And if you vary W1 with respect to the gauge field and metric, then what you're going to get are a stress tensor and a current that end up exactly reproducing ideal hydrodynamics. Kind of tells you that you're on the right track here. You can actually do a lot more with this. You can classify tensor structures up to second order in derivatives and compute the stress tensor and current. And remarkably, you get precise agreement with second order hydro once you turn off all the real-time coefficients, all the real-time transport coefficients. What this is telling you is that these general properties about field theory are somehow what's going into constructing hydrodynamics, even though you didn't realize it.
Excuse me.
Yeah, yeah.
I think I'm a bit confused. How do you get equation for the velocity?
Sorry?
How do you get an equation for U mu?
Oh, so U mu is determined in terms of V mu, which is this time-like vector field in the background that you're using to define it. So the physics is you have this vector field V mu, and you can then define the generator of translations along V mu as H. And that allows you to define a thermal partition function. That's sort of the, so, and then everything is determined in terms of beta and V in the background metric in gauge field. So if you chose V to just be just ordinary time translation, then U mu would be 1 over square root minus G0, for instance. The local temperature would be 1 over beta, the coordinate periodicity of the time circle, square root minus G0. And the chemical potential, say we worked in coordinates where, like, in coordinates where that like your every all the different metric functions and gauge field components were time independent, then the chemical potential would just be that fluid velocity dotted into the gauge field. So I guess to be really explicit, it would be 1 over square root minus G naught naught A0. And then in those coordinates, you can compute T and J. And then you get epsilon U mu U nu plus P delta mu nu, and then similarly for the current. And I should say that the physics of this construction is is essentially that you're taking all the properties that you know about Euclidean field theory at low momentum, and you're building them. You have a construction that manifests all those properties by construction. So for instance, analyticity of zero frequency functions is manifest by writing out some local functional. Local gauge coordinate invariance is manifest by writing down W in terms of Lorentz invariance, gauge invariance scalars. On a manifold with a U1 cycle, there are extra Ward identities, sort of related to the global topology of the background. And it's not obvious, but this construction is taking those into it, taking care of those as well. And then finally, there's a property of zero frequency functions that you can think of as some sort of reciprocity. If you have two bosonic operators, you can interchange them and you'll get the same correlation function back again. This is obvious from the generating functional because bosonic variational derivatives commute. That property is obvious from a generating functional. It's not obvious if you try to compute these functions in hydro. Okay, well, this is all very general. Let's learn something about anomalies. Specialize, again, to a 4D theory with a U1 anomaly. There's some parity violation. And you can check, in order to get a current that satisfies the right Ward identity, that tells you that the anomalous variation of the generating functional has to go like epsilon FF. And you can get that from a term that looks just like this. If you compute the gauge variation of this, it'll precisely reproduce this expression up here. That's really interesting because what is the physics of that is telling you that somehow in these equilibrium states, the anomalous part of the generating functional, which is usually some Wessimino term, something non-local, you can write it down in a completely local way. So there's the expression. There's the anomalous part of W. Actually, the story is a little bit more complicated than that. If I allow myself to violate parity, there is a single CPT-preserving parity-violating term that you can also write down in W that has a single derivative that looks like this. It looks very strange, but the physics of it is really simple. If you dimensionally reduce on the time circle to some functional on the spatial slice, then this thing is like a mixed Chern-Simons term between the U1 connection in the 3D theory and the KK U1 connection for the fibration. So if you were to write out the metric, this and write out the gauge field as say something like this, then that term is proportional to, I'm running out of space here, that term is proportional to C tilde 4D A hat wedge DA on the spatial slice. And the fact that this thing is a Chern-Simons term effectively tells you that this coefficient has to be a genuine constant in order for that term to be gauge invariant. Okay, big picture. At first order derivatives with an anomaly, we have the term that gives you the anomaly, and there's also one more term that you can write down up to a constant, an overall constant. And if you recall 20 minutes ago when I was summarizing what Son and Peter Sirota did, that's exactly what they had sitting in their transport coefficients. So unsurprisingly, if you compute the stress tensor and current for this generating functional, you precisely match what Son and Peter found from the NHP current. Once you make some identification between this constant that I wrote down and the constant that I wrote there, which I called F2. This is something of a, this is a good punchline. Well, what this tells you is that, it tells you a number of things. One, just a bare minimum, you've taken this interesting result that was obtained through this entropy current and hydrodynamics and things that maybe you don't necessarily trust. And you've derived them from symmetry properties of, and from symmetries and properties of Euclidean field theory. Great. Okay, so you really believe it. Another thing you learn is that these connectivities are, if you will, just a consequence of a consistent description of thermodynamics once you include all these extra background fields. So they're really thermodynamic in origin. There's this thing I said before that the anomalous part of W is local. If you tried to do this at zero temperature and write down the anomalous part of the generating functional, you would get, you get what you have in ADS CFT, a Chern-Simons term in one higher dimension, something that's not local. So that's interesting. And then it should be kind of clear, but this is already a good part of the way towards replacing hydrodynamics entirely and talking about effective field theory instead, which I like. However, there's a fly in the ointment. There's a problem. Well, not really a problem. There's an unfixed coefficient that's left. This guy, this C40 tilde, this coefficient of this Chern-Simons term. And while it'd be nice to actually fix it in terms of other quantities, if we can do so, but moreover, I should say that this term is probably the one that will, it's the one that gives you the biggest experimental signature for the chiral vortical effect in heavy ion experiments. The simple reason, now, and it's very simple to see why that is. If you go back to this chiral vortical connectivity, so here's your expression for the current stuff plus sigma CVE times the vorticity, this thing ends up having two terms in it. There's a term that roughly goes like the U1 anomaly coefficient times mu squared, plus a second term that's like C4D tilde times T squared. And then the statement is very simple. In typical collisions at heavy ion colliders, the temperatures are much bigger than the chemical potentials that you generate. In fact, for just the ballpark numbers that you would stick in for the RIT physics, this term would dominate this, the one that comes from the U1 anomaly, by a factor of 10,000 or so. So understanding the physics of this term is actually important for experiments. And while I'll keep going, which tells you that we can actually learn something about this, this term is proportional to the mixed gauge gravitational anomaly coefficient. That's the punchline. I should, before outlining the calculation, let me give some backstory. Because the story here really started in 2011 when Carl Landsteiner with a couple postdocs of his did a, well, they first sat down and worked out Kubo formulae for this this transport coefficient that I wrote down over there. What is it? You compute this mixed correlation function of the vector part of the current with the vector part of the stress tensor, and you can have some parity violating structure, and then the rest of that guy, that's the chiral vortical connectivity. And then what some subset of Carl and collaborators did, and they didn't know it at the time, I think, but this is reproducing some old calculation of the Lincolns from the 80s in the context of neutrino physics. But what they did then was they calculated this one loop diagram. They computed the one loop contribution to this correlation function. And when you do this, you end up finding out that this coefficient C4D tilde for a theory with a single free fermion is 1/12. And if you want to rewrite it in a suggestive way, you say that that's minus 8 pi squared cm. Where cm is the mixed anomaly coefficient that you get for a free Dirac fermion. Okay, that's a little bit funny, but they had another calculation in mind when they did this, namely a strong coupling calculation using ADS CFT that was posted to the archive a few months later. And what they did, they considered a gravitational dual in ADS-5 where you have a Chern-Simons term that gives you the mixed anomaly and the boundary theory. It looks like that. And then they compute the same two-point function from linear response in the standard way. And lo and behold, they find the same relation that they found at weak coupling between this integration constant and the mixed anomaly coefficient. And then you say, aha, you have this calculation at weak coupling, you have this calculation at strong coupling, you conjecture that it's always an identity, that you always have this matching between this Stern-Simons coupling and CM. Then the problem becomes, can you prove it? Unfortunately, this is hard. In fact, there's two a priori reasons that are worth thinking about for a little bit for why this is hard. The first one is very simple. The mixed anomaly shows up through, in, say, the conservation equations, through things that look like divergence of the current goes like trace R squared. And, well, this has four derivatives. Actually, let me notate that differently. Order derivative to the four. And the terms that involve the Stern-Simons coupling show up in here at order derivative squared. And naively, there's no way for these terms at different order in the derivatives to talk to each other. And in fact, you can really make that precise in this generating functional. The gravitational anomaly is going to give you some terms in the generating functional that have three derivatives that are completely unrelated to the ones that have one derivative, like the Stern-Simons term. So that's a problem. The second thing, notice that there's a factor of 8 pi squared. That factor is transcendental, obviously. But it's if you stare at this for a while and you check to make sure you're not using some screwy normalization, you'll realize that there's no way that the entropy current method or this thing that I described with the generating functional is going to give you a relation like this. Those methods all give you algebraic relations of the form coefficient in the generating functional is equal to another coefficient times an algebraic number, not pi squared. So you really need something else. But fortunately, we're string theorists, and so there, if you think for a while, there's an example that behaves just like this that we all know about in 2D CFT, which is the Carney formula, remarkably enough. And one way of thinking about the Carney formula is that the pressure, which in a 2D CFT has to be proportional to T squared, the coefficient in front of the pressure is fixed to be proportional to the conformal anomaly, to the central charge. And of course, this happens because the vacuum state is conformal to the thermal state. And so when you do the conformal transformation, you effectively pick up the pressure from the inhomogeneities and the Schwarzian derivative, and blah, blah, blah. But notice that this satisfies both of these screwy properties I mentioned on the previous slide. The pressure is something that has no, it tells you something about the generating functional when there's no derivatives, whereas the central charge corresponds to some two derivative terms in the generating functional. So the Carney formula mixes orders in the derivative expansion, and what it also does, it introduces the transcendental factor of 4 pi squared, which in this case just comes from factors of from the period of the angular direction and the vacuum state squared. So with this in mind, you can ask, can we adapt the inspiration behind the Carney formula to learn about these transport coefficients? And since I'm running out of time, suffice it to say, yes, you can. The basic idea is consider, say we work with a 2D theory instead of a 4D theory for a moment, and then we'll do the 4D in just a few minutes. Take your 2D theory and put it on R2, but delete the origin. It's a relatively safe thing to do. And now, on this R2, treat the angular direction as Euclidean time. And write down the thermal partition function associated with that Euclidean time, that trace e to the minus beta h. Well, if you subject that state to background fields which are independent of the angular direction, which are independent of Euclidean time, then that partition function has to agree with the vacuum partition function. Which means that, well, for instance, you can use that thermal partition function to compute the stress tensor of the vacuum state. It's really remarkable. And then you can impose the fact that the vacuum state of a relativistic theory has more symmetry than the thermal state. In particular, it has full Poincaré invariance. So for a 2D CFT, that stress tensor had better vanish. I should say that there's two potential problems with this. One is that, if you stare at this expression that I wrote down for the local temperature, and you plug in that metric, you find that the gradients of the temperature are not small. So in other words, there's no way, the derivative is order one. There's no meaning, you can't say that, say, like an order derivative squared term is much smaller than a three derivative term. So the derivative expansion breaks down. The second possible issue is that maybe something went wrong when you deleted the origin from R2. So if you have a theory which has states with spin greater than one that could be sensitive to global topology, like if you delete a point or some line from your space, then the partition functions will not necessarily agree, and then there's issues. Yes?
This was not a CFT, or was it a CFT?
Well, what we'll do first is the CFT, and then we'll go away from.
So how do you pick the boundary condition of the half line so that you get the vacuum state? So I guess this identity is true if you put the correct boundary conditions on the half line.
In order to find a thermal partition function, I really need a compact time direction. I really need a non-trivial cycle. And if I just have half space with half line, then I don't have any obvious U1 cycle to make my Euclidean time direction.
This thermal partition function is on half line, right?
No. It's on R2, deleting the origin.
But then what?
Treat this, yeah.
Yeah, so you're putting a linear temperature on the theory on the ray.
Yes.
So they need to pick boundary conditions at the origin of the ray?
Where the temperature formally diverges?
Yes.
No, we don't find that we have to impose boundary conditions there.
So somehow you produce that because you might think that you produce some other operator which is not identity.
Right, so you could ask, so when you delete this point, you could ask, are you having some other operator insertion at the origin? I don't think that's what's happening.
I mean, somehow the choice of boundary condition on the half line should decide which operator you have identity naively at the origin.
Okay. Then I think, yes, good. And then I think the statement is here that we impose sort of trivial boundary conditions, the naive shut up and calculate ones. And I think the claim is that those boundary conditions tell you that your operator insertion at the origin is one. It's just the vacuum. Okay, I'll speed up. Won't be much longer. If you have a 2D CFT and you try to write down this generating functional, there's only a very small number of terms that you can write down if you demand that all the background fields are time translation invariant. So you have the usual pressure term. You have this a term that's kind of like an analog of this Chern-Simons term up in four dimensions. And then you have two terms that give you, respectively, the conformal and gravitational anomalies. And the great thing about a 2D CFT is that all the other local terms you would try to write down violate Weyl invariants. There's nothing else you can write down that can contribute. So that's it for the thermal partition function. In which case, you can compute the stress tensor from that. You don't have to worry about potential higher derivative terms that you haven't classified spoiling the day. You just compute the stress tensor. That's what you get in this background. And then you use the fact that the stress tensor of a 2D CFT should vanish. And that relates the pressure to the central charge. And that relates that constant C2D tilde to the gravitational anomaly coefficient. That's exactly what we want up in higher dimensions. as well. But this is the gist of how you do it. I should say what this C2D tilde thing is giving you in a 2D CFT. You probably know this, that if you study the equilibrium state in 2D CFT at non-zero temperature, a gravitational anomaly will give you a Casimir momentum. It's like some non-zero momentum. And that's effectively what C2D is tilde is giving you. Okay. That was for a CFT. What happens if you lose conformal invariance? Then, well, the calculation a priori becomes infinitely more complicated, because there are an infinite number of terms that can contribute to the partition function with an arbitrarily high number of derivatives, and there's no meaningful suppression of scales where you can say that the 16 derivative terms are much smaller than the small ones. So a priori, you know nothing. However, if you stare at things for a while, you realize that actually, if you restrict yourself to turning on very particular sources, the ones that mix Euclidean, the angular direction and the radial direction, that they're, of all this infinite number of higher derivative terms that you can write down, all of them are at least quadratic in this fluctuation, except for two terms. And those two terms are the same ones that I wrote down here. There's this one that's like a Chern-Simons term, and then there's this gravitational anomaly term. So even though there's this, in a general 2D theory, there's an infinite number of other terms, none of them contribute to T tau R. And as a result, this thermal partition function allows you to reliably compute that component of the stress tensor, which by the Poincaré invariance of the vacuum should vanish. And then that gives you a relation between this Chern-Simons term and the gravitational anomaly. And now I can tell the 4D story with one slide. Simplest way to understand this 4D result is to do something that's very natural to us. Take your 4D theory, put it on a compact space, like a two-sphere, thread the two-sphere with magnetic flux, and then put it across R2 again, and then treat the angular direction inside that R2 as Euclidean time. And in the language of dimensional reduction, the 4D mixed anomaly gives you a 2D gravitational anomaly. The 4D Chern-Simons coupling gives you a 2D Chern-Simons coupling, and then you just use the result from the previous slide. And that relates the 4D mixed anomaly to the 4D Chern-Simons. And you're done. I've already gone 5 minutes over, so I'll be very brief in what's next. There is some work in progress. I tried to structure my conversation about hydro to sound very much like effective field theory, and something that we are trying to do is to get rid of hydro altogether and talk about the effective field theory, or the space of effective field theories for thermal field theory. And you might ask, why do you do this? There's some aesthetic reasons, like, I don't know, being able to put all this business about the entropy current on, like to be able to derive the entropy current, things like this. But there's a real world problem, which is that it's easily phrased, say, for ADF CFT. Imagine that you compute loop corrections in the bulk to correlation functions of the stress tensor in the boundary theory. Well, you'll have some sum over all the bulk modes, and if you're, say, an ADS5 Schwarzschild, you'll sum over all the quasi-normal modes in the bulk in the right way. And those quasi-normal modes in the bulk include the hydro modes, the low momentum modes, the ones that are gapless. And if you look at the stress tensor at low momenta, those loop corrections will be dominated by the corrections that come from hydro modes running around in loops in the bulk. And those can give you all sorts of interesting and rich behavior. In the field theory side, the statement is that when you write down hydro, it's like writing down an effective theory of the hydrodynamic modes. And of course, in a quantum theory, you can have loop corrections where the hydro modes run around in loops and can give you interesting effects. And all of those corrections are completely neglected in classical hydro. And it's very hard to write down a formalism that allows you to reliably compute those loop corrections. Whereas if you have the effective field theory for hydro, then you can just do, you know, your favorite three-loop calculation in net theory and know the answer. That's one thing that we're doing. Another thing, I should say that this the statement that this C40 tilde is exactly related to CM, I didn't emphasize this enough at the beginning. That's really all the discussion that I gave was in terms of anomalies for global symmetry currents. However, in real-world systems like the standard model, the AVV anomaly, the axial vector-vector anomaly, involves a global symmetry current, the axial current, and then vector currents which couple to a dynamical gauge field. And all the discussion that I gave neglected possible perturbative corrections that can arise from coupling your having an anomalous current talk to dynamical gauge fields through the anomaly. And indeed, there are some perturbative corrections that have just been computed. And I should also say that with Laganayagam and with Amos Jerome, we now have some technology in place that allows us to compute the anomalous part of the generating functional for arbitrary anomalies and arbitrary dimensions, provided the background fields are time independent. So, for instance, yesterday I was cranking through the 6D gravitational anomalies, and you end up with very simple expressions, and there's lots of fun things that you can do with them. That's what I have to say today. Thank you folks very much for listening. I guess the conclusion is that in general in physics, we learn lots of exact results when we have extra symmetries in the game. When we have supersymmetry or conformal symmetry or infinite dimensional symmetries corresponding to integrability, and the main player today are extra symmetries that emerge in Euclidean field theory. That was what gave us all the machinery that we did. So thank you folks very much.